take your Bibles out and turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We will begin there in just a moment. We are going to look at the second part of our lesson that deals with the subject of a more excellent way. Last week, we began looking at this subject and looking at the most excellent way. And we're talking about the subject of love and how it interacts our lives. And last week we showed that in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, the Apostle Paul wrote this particular chapter in the Corinthian letter after he had made a number of statements concerning some problems that the church of Corinth was experiencing. They had carnality. They were selfish in their pride. There was secretarianism that was being done because they were calling themselves after men instead of following the Lord. And then they had worldly wisdom instead of leading to divine wisdom. And then they had toleration of immorality. They had sin that was even among them, and they weren't dealing with it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, a man had his father's wife, and they were not chastening him. They weren't correcting him and rebuking that conduct, and they were taking the task for that in 1 Corinthians 5. And then they were suing one another in civil court for differences that two brethren had between one another. And instead of coming together and finding a solution between brethren, they were going to the unbeliever and trying to get a solution. And so they rebuked for that. In chapters 8 through 10, they had prideful knowledge. And we're talking about in the first century, the Gentiles, they came out of pagan religion. Pagan religion, they offered animals and sacrifice, and then they would take those animals and they would sell them in the marketplace after they were used in their rituals. And of course, there's nothing unclean about an animal under the new law. But it was tender to the conscience of a Gentile. If a Gentile saw an animal that somebody prepared over them offered in a ritual, it offended their conscience. And so even though they had liberty to eat their animal, if it would cause a problem for their brother, they should refrain from doing that. And so Paul rebukes them for that. In 1 Corinthians 11, they had corrupted the Lord's Supper. They had turned it into a common meal. And they had lost the significance of the spirituality and the reason and the purpose of the Lord's Supper in commemorating the Lord's death. And then in chapters 12 through 14, he deals with the misuse of spiritual gifts. Not just the misuse of them, but the misunderstanding of why the gifts were given and how the gifts were to be used in order to do the things that God would have them to do. And so he addresses that in chapters 12, 13, and 14. And then last week, we looked at the first three verses of this text that dealt with the vanity of things that are not done in love. And that's really the first basis of this chapter, and that's what we covered last week, that if love is not the motive behind our actions, then our actions mean nothing. They can't profit us nothing. There's nothing that will be accomplished. But today we're going to look at the last two parts of this chapter, and that is the character of love. We're going to look at that this morning and look at how love is defined. How does the Bible define? What does love look like? We're going to get a biblical definition of what we should see in love. And that's in verses 4 through 7. And then at the end of this text that we will cover tonight, it has to do with the ending of spiritual gifts and how spiritual gifts are going to end. Don't get enamored with them. Don't fall in love with them, because they are not going to last. They are temporary, and they don't have durability. But there are other things that have durability, and one of those things is the character of love. Now, as we discussed last week, we're talking about the strongest type of love. Love which is awakened by a sense of value of an object, which causes one to prize it. It is a love of esteem and appropriation. Now, what we're saying is, this type of love is a self-sacrificing type of love. This is the love that God expects us to have for Him, for the church, for the truth, for one another, for the lost, and for our fellow man. That is our duty. That is our responsibility given us by God. And the Bible is full of passages that emphasize that. This is a type of love that is an act of will, not emotion. This is not a warm, fuzzy feeling. This is an act of a will. This is a choice that we make. And we talked last week about loving our enemies. That's not something that we're born to do. That's not something we would do naturally. That's something that we might have to work on to be able to love and pray for our enemies. And we looked at Matthew chapter 5, and we looked at the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10. But then it does not occur by chance. This is not a type of love you fall into and fall out of. This is a type of love that you have to develop. You have to work upon, and you have to continually strive to have this type of love in your life. And we looked at several passages from the book of John. And we looked at how the Bible infers and it applies that we are to have a special relationship even among ourselves as brethren. And then it's the opposite of selflessness. And we looked for a brief time in Philippians chapter 2 when we looked at that we not only should be interested in our own interest, but we should esteem others better than ourselves. That we need to look out for others' interests better than we do our own. Now, the reason that we point that out is because only when I love God as I should, as I've been commanded, as God has asked, when I learn to love God that way, I will be able to love others as God has commanded me. If I can't love God the way that He wants me to, I am never going to have the ability to love others the way that God has instructed me to do so. And it's expressed to those who do not deserve it. Jesus died not because we deserved it. He didn't die because we were worthy of it. He didn't die because He was obligated to die. He died because He loved us. He died because He knew that we needed it. Romans 5, verse 8, we looked at this last week, that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And it's not exclusive or partial. He didn't just die for a few people. He died for everyone. He takes the death for every man. Hebrews 2, verse 16. As we read in John 3, verse 16, He loved the world that He gave His life. It's not just for select few. Calvinism says that He only died for the elect. That's false. He died for the whole world. He died to give them the opportunity that they could gain redemption. It is active in providing what is needed. Our perfect example is Jesus Christ. He is active in providing what is needed. He did what was ever necessary in order to show His love for others. He did whatever that meant, whatever degree of whatever action He had to undertake, He did that in order to demonstrate love. Does not overlook or excuse one sin. Jesus didn't sweep sin out of the carpet. He didn't do it then, He doesn't do it now. Sin has to be addressed. Sin has to be dealt with. Sin must be paid for. That is part of God's law. It cannot just be experienced away. It just can't be imagined away. It's something that must be dealt with. God dealt with it, we must deal with it. Now, are we willing to love like Jesus loved? Jesus instructed His disciples to love like He loved them. We read this last week in John 13. The followers of Christ are to have a deep and abiding love for one another. We discussed 1 Peter 1, verse 22. It says, unfeigned love of the brethren. That means genuine. It means something that's real, not something that's put on to show, not something that we just give lip service to. It's something that is real, something that you can see, something that's active. And it's a test of our discipleship. It is something that tells people who we are. It tells people that we belong to the Lord. It explains to them that there is a better way to live life. And it is something that shows people that we belong to the Lord. And if we don't have that type of love, then we send a mixed message. And then we're not being the kind of people that God would have us to be, and that's going to be a problem. Now, we looked at this characteristic of heathen worship the clanging of cymbals. Even the coveted gift of tongues was no better than the uproar of heathen religion if love was absent. Remember, it didn't make any difference what gift you have. If you did not use it with love, if you did not use it with love and concern for others, that gift was useless to you. It was unprofitable for you. It would not help you. And so it had to be motivated by love. If the highest possible manifestation of tongue, of prophecy, of knowledge, of faith, of benevolence, and sacrifice are rendered pointless by lovelessness, then so are all other deeds and words. Listen to what I'm saying. If love is not the reason what we do and why we do it is pointless. It has no meaning to God. It will not benefit us with our relationship with God. It is absolutely necessary. It is absolutely essential that every action that we take as God's children, it is motivated and it is dependent upon the love that I have first and foremost for God, and second, the love that I have for you or whoever I might be doing, whatever I'm doing for, it must be motivated by love. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I don't want to leave you with any misconception. There is no way that I can literally, or I know, the motive of what you do and why you do. But I don't need to know. I'm just going to assume the best. I'm going to assume that you do it out of love, unless I see evidence that that's not true. But I'm going to assume that your motive is love. But I want you to understand this one point. God knows what your motive is. God knows why you do what you do. He knows why you act upon any situation and why you do it. And he is the one that will judge you. And so we need to be very careful that we love in a way that does not prove to be vanity. What is a love that is vanity? It is a love that is not done by a biblical definition. So that leads us to where we're at today. What does love look like? How can you know by a person's actions if love is present? Well, God gave us a definition of what love looks like. And it's contained in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4 through verse 7. I want you to turn to that, and we're going to read that, and then we're going to go through this list. Because this is what love looks like. When man has the proper love that he should have, this is what it looks like. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It is not puffed up. Does not behave rudely. Does not seek its own. Is not provoked. Thinks no evil. Does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in truth. Excuse me. Bears all things. Believes all things. Hopes all things. Endures all things. Now, you could preach a series of lessons on every one of these elements. But what I want to do for the remaining time we have this morning, I want to give you an understanding of what those things mean, what they look like and why we do. First of all, it emphasizes being. A closer look at the character of love. Who are we? Who we are is more important than what we do. Now what we do is important. But who we are, why do we do it? What is the motive? Examining ourselves. Where we are. What can we do to grow? Brethren, it's important that you do things for other people. It's important that you have a servant's heart. You know, a few months ago, I did a lesson on having a servant's heart. We must have a servant's heart. But that servant's heart must be emphasizing and done out of love. If it's not done, if we're serving others because we have to, because that's what God requires us to do, because that's what we must do in order to please God, it's not going to work. It's not going to be real. It's not going to be genuine. It's not going to really be a sacrifice. Because you're not doing it because you want to. You're not doing it because you want to do it. You're doing it because you're forced to do it. You know what? I believe in our lives that we can tell when love is freely given and when love is forced. When it's done because they have to do it. I think we can easily tell the difference, can't we? Can you tell the difference when somebody's doing something because it genuinely wants to do it and desires to do it, or when somebody does it because, well, that's what they're supposed to do? Now, which do you appreciate more? The one that's done because they want to, or the one that does it because he has to? I think you and I both know the answer to that. And that's what God wants to see. He wants to see not something we just simply do because we have to, but we do it because we want to do it, we desire to do it. We know that's the best. And so it's a process. Becoming a genuine, loving person is a process. You have to, first of all, understand love's character. You have to do things that engender love. There are wonder ways that you can have love and you can engender love in others in how you treat them, how you talk about them, how you interact with them. You know, you can become a reciprocal relationship that you can express love, you can do love, and it will come back to you. That's what God really wants. That's what God is hoping for. Being honest with ourselves. You know what? You've got to be painfully honest with yourself. You know why you do what you do. You know what your motive is. You know, let me ask you a question. When you do something for someone, somebody is hurting, somebody's had a death in the family, somebody has tragedy come, and you go to do it, do you do it because it's expected of you to do it? Do you do it so people understand that you were there, that you answered the bell? Or do you do it because you want to do it? You want to be able to help them. You want to be able to comfort them. You want to be able to help them bear the grief or the burden of the difficulty. Or do you do it out of obligation because that's just something you're supposed to do? Now, ladies and gentlemen, the person you do it for, they never know the difference. But rest assured, God does. And whether or not it is being accredited to us as being a faithful servant of His is going to be determined by how we do it and why we do it. And so we have to be honest with ourselves. And we have to do this in a way that is for the proper motive and for the proper reason. Now, what does love look like? Well, let's let God tell us. It suffers wrong. Look at the word. Suffers wrong. Not quick to punish or to retaliate, wrongs incurred. Associated with mercy. You know what? You have to suffer with the human race. Because at times, they're very insufferable. There's times that they're not very good. There's times that they're not very kind. There's times that they're not very appreciative. Now, here's one of the things I want you to remember. What other people do with what I do. If I do something for someone, and I'm doing it out of genuine immovable law. Whatever that person does, doesn't matter. If they don't receive it, if they don't appreciate it, if they throw it in my face, it doesn't matter. You cannot control that. You are not responsible for that. All you're responsible for is to do it, and to do it with genuine love in your heart. Now, are there people that you have to suffer with longer than with other people? Are there people that you're going to have to really, you're going to really have to suffer long in order to try to help them? And there's people like that. Let me give you an example. In Romans 12, it says, as much as lies within you, live peaceably with all men. Romans 12, 18. Now, are there some people that make it tough to live with peace with them? Is there people that make it very difficult for you to be at peace with them? Yes, but you know what that passage means? It means as much as lies within you. I can do my part. As much as lies within my conduct, with my action, I'm going to do whatever is necessary for peace. But I cannot do anything about the other person. But whatever that other person does not change what my responsibility is. My responsibility is to do what God tells me to do, and I ought to do it because I want to do it. You know what? If you do it because you have to do it, it's not going to be very genuine. And it's going to come off as not being very genuine. If you just do it because you have to do it. Now, you know what? Do you love your children because you have to? No. You love your children because they're precious to you. Because you want to love them because they mean so much to you. It's easy to do that. But you know what? You've got to learn to love people when it's not easy. That's a real gift, to love people when it's not easy. That's when you have to have long suffering. It says it is kind, sympathetic, sweetness of temper, rendering good instead of pain. You know what the world needs is kindness. Genuine kindness. A tender spirit. Someone that is sympathetic and sweet. Someone that you know has your best interest at heart. Can you tell that? Can you tell when a person is a kindred spirit, when they're a crew? I think we can tell that. I think that's something that you can demonstrate and people can see. It is not jealous. It is not boastful or arrogant. It is meek. It is humble. You know, there are people who have abilities that I wish I had. Am I jealous of them? Am I envious of them because they can do things that I cannot do? I shouldn't be. I should never be. You know what? I appreciate people who can make sense. That's something I don't have the talent to do. I'm not envious of them. I'm with Bill. I'm not envious because they can do it, or Mel, or Marsha. I'm not envious of that. I'm glad that they can do that. I'm glad they have that ability, and they're willing to use it. I should never be envious because somebody can do something I cannot do. And if there are people, and you know what, there are just people who are really good at showing concern for another person. They're just really good at it. You know, I remember when I was in Ohio, we had a lady, a sister there. And this lady was just what I call down to earth. She was so genuine in everything she did. And it just came across so easily. I mean, without any, you know, it was something that it was a pleasure for her to do. She looked forward to do it. And you knew it by just the way she did it. And she was a joy to be around. And when that person came to help you, you knew that person really wanted to help you. You know, not everybody has that kind of gift. Not everybody can do that. You know, there are people who are very good of dealing with grief and helping people cope with it. And you know those other people? They struggle with that. They really struggle in how to make that connection with someone who is grieving. You know, what we need to understand is you don't have to be good at it. You know, I remember years ago, Brother Connie Adams, and talking about this particular subject. And he was using that example when his first wife, Bobby, died. And he says, you know, the funeral home was packed. There were hundreds of people there. He says, I don't even remember they were there. But what I do remember, they talked to me, they said things to me. He said, I couldn't tell you one thing they told me. But I can tell you what I do remember. I remember they were there. I remember they hugged me. They told me they loved me. They told me they were praying for me. That's a simple thing, isn't it? That's a very simple thing, isn't it? But that's something that has meaning to somebody that's hurting. That has meaning. You know what? People have always asked me in the job that I have that I get a lot of this. That I have to be in situations to help people. And I have to be people that help them through grief and through tragedy. And people ask me, well, how do you do that? Well, how do you get up there and how do you preach at a funeral when you know people are hurting? The grieving, the loss is overwhelming. How do you get up there? How do you do that? You know, I can't speak for everybody, but I just speak for myself. You know what I do? I try to think, what would I want somebody to do if that was me? If that was me who was hurting and grieving, what would I want them to do? So that's what I do. I try to do what I think that I want people to do for me. And you know what? I try to remember that I'm trying. And you know what? It's overwhelming. It really is. To try to find something to comfort people when you know they're hurting. It's overwhelming. I mean, it can just overwhelm you. But just step back for a minute. You know the person who's in that position? They know what kind of position you're in. They know what you're trying to do. They understand how difficult it is for you to be able to find the words, the actions, to say whatever you need. They understand how difficult it is because they've been in that position too. They just appreciate that you make the effort. Don't shy away from that. Don't shy away from it because you think you don't have the ability. Sometimes all you have to do is be there. That's all you have to do. That says more than you think it says. We need not to be boastful or arrogant. Does not behave rudely. Love always conducts itself with proper decorum. Arrogance treats others with contempt. Does not behave rudely. Let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. It's easy to tell when a person's rude or when a person is not very thoughtful. You know, people sometimes need to think about what they say. You know, we might look at a given situation and we might know the mistakes that were made to bring that situation about. But when that person is hurting, you don't pile on the hurt. You know, you don't pile it on because that's rude. And you know what? It does make a difference what you say and how you say it. The tone of your voice and how you address people. It does make a difference. It is rude to judge other people. Now what do you mean? I said, well, wait a minute. We're to judge, yeah. The Bible says make righteous judgments. But you know what? I can look at a situation and I can see the pain and anguish and I can know that that person's decisions really led them to where they ended up. I know that, and the person who's grieving, they also know that. That's not the time or place to be rude. That's not the time or place to say, well, they kind of brought that on themselves. You don't have to say that. You know, that's obvious, but you don't have to say it. That's just not appropriate. It's like, I'll give you an example with myself. It's harder and harder for me to go to a funeral service and watch people preach into heaven. It just goes all over me. I mean, it just gets all over me. They talk about somebody that I knew, somebody that I had an acquaintance with, that had no spiritual bone in his body, never had time for God, never tried to live for God, and yet they're talking like this man was a saint walked on the earth. And I know that that wasn't really the man that they're talking about. So, should I go up to him and say, man, you missed that by preaching, man? So, I don't know who you were talking about. You sure you weren't talking about that now? You know what? There's a time and place where that conversation could be held. But at that particular time, that's not the place. Let me give you a personal example of what I'm talking about. When my brother died many years ago, I came home. I was 20 years old. And I was down in the basement of the funeral home where we were at. And my two aunts were downstairs. And I happened to come down there to check on my father because my father was down there. Now, let me give you a little background about this. Before I came home, my mom and dad had been divorced for about 3 months. My dad had remarried. And so all of this is all new to me. Okay, I've been gone 14 months. And here are my two aunts fussing with my father about making sure that he didn't bring his new wife to the get-together after the funeral. I came down there and I got between the three of them. I said, listen, my brother is laying upstairs and his son is laying upstairs. This is not the time nor the place to have this discussion. This is inappropriate. It's not being compassionate. It's not showing thoughtfulness. Now, I know why they did it. They did it because they were concerned about my mother. But I guarantee you, my mother wasn't thinking one thing about that. She was thinking about the loss of her son. There's things that are appropriate. There's a time and a place to say things. And there is never a right time to be rude or to be uncompassionate. We need to think about what we're doing. But whether a genuine concern for the well-being of others, it is not selfish. We don't do things out of selfishness. Not provoke. Love does not provoke or go around with a chip on its shoulder. I should never try to provoke ill will in another person. I should never try to provoke a bad reaction from another person. Even when I do what's right, if I'm trying to provoke that person, if I'm trying to get at that person, then that's not love. And that's inappropriate. Thinks no evil. Love does not dwell on evils it has incurred. Evil is a fatal soul for bitterness and resentment. Love does not think evil. I'm not going to think evil because of a certain given situation. And I'm saying, well, that person, that thing, that happened because this person did that. You know what? It's not important why it happened then. It's not important in all the details then. It's not important on why it happened, how it could have been prevented. That's the time for another discussion. That's not the time to do it. It doesn't think evil. I'll give you an excellent example. Someone comes forward here who's struggling with a problem. Maybe it's an addiction. Maybe it's being consistent in their faith. Maybe it's being consistent in the relationship with God. And they come forward and you can hear people whispering, well, I wonder how long this will stick. That's wrong attitude. You can't fake evil. You can't fake evil. Your heart's in the wrong place. And you know what? There are times when you really got to work on this, because people have a pattern in their life that they seem to keep on making the same mistake. That may be true, but you can't think evil. You've got to think the best. You've got to think positively and not negatively. And you know what? When we think evil, our heart's in the wrong place. We've got to work on that, that we not do that. Love does not rejoice in iniquity. Love finds no pleasure in hearing the moral weakness of another. Love realizes the high cost of sin. Sin hurts the sinner, and all who love that person, it hurts them. Love never encourages someone in wrongdoing. Love does not tempt another to ever act in a way that would not cause another to do evil. Let me give you an example of this. A number of years ago, there was a pretty well-known preacher who fell into the sin of adultery. And he was very well-known. Matter of fact, he did a lot of good in his life. And he was a very well-known evangelist. He was a very, very good debater. And he was very, very focused. When he was debating, if you didn't have the truth, this is not a guy you want to debate. Because he could come across as being somebody that lacked compassion, that just was very straightforward, that I used to call him a junkyard dog. But he looked at the person who believed error, he looked at it as a danger to the soul of the man who could be led away into that error. And he wanted to make sure that person couldn't lead somebody into error. Well, he fell into the sin of adultery. He ended up destroying him. He ended up destroying his marriage. And I was at a gathering of a bunch of preachers, and his name got brought up. And a couple of the preachers said, "Man, I'm so glad it happened to him. I hope it happened to him." I said, "You know what, brother? You need to go home and you need to ask God to forgive you. Because you have a bigger problem than he does. Because you can't be happy because somebody falls into sin. You can't be happy because somebody destroyed his life with sin. That's not anything that we can gloat about. That's nothing that we should be happy about. And it bothers me when people who are supposed to be preaching the gospel don't have any more sense than that. You cannot be happy when a person destroys their life with sin." But I knew they'd do that. So that served them right. When they got decision, they did exactly what they deserved. Brother, your heart's not right. That's not your call. You're not God. I'm not God. And we can't be happy if somebody commits sin and it destroys their life, their soul's in jeopardy. Their soul is headed to eternal destruction unless they fix it. How can you be happy about that? Can't be happy about that. When you do, then you've got a problem. We can never rejoice when someone falls. You know, there's a real temptation when somebody's been ugly to me, been unkind to me, and then they fall into sin, you sit back and think, "Good. I'm glad it happened to you." Brethren, you can lose your soul over that. Realize that you can lose your soul. You can lose your soul because you're grumbling because somebody fell into sin. Love does not do that. And that's not love if you do that. Love rejoices in the truth. Christians' love has no wish to bear the truth. It is big enough to face the truth. Love is never ashamed of the truth. Love will speak the truth in the most difficult of situations. Love rejoices when the truth is obeyed and returned to or propagated. I have to rejoice in the truth. I can't be ashamed of what I believe. You know, let me give you an example. A few days ago, while I was in Lexington, And I went to see Sister and Melissa and Donna. I had to go by Cardinal Hill. So I went in to see Kim King. And she was there with her husband, Gary. And I talked to Gary on a number of occasions, and Kim too. Now, me and Mrs. Kim, we have religious differences. And we do have them. But I didn't go there to talk about our religious differences. I went there to try to say that I hope that you get better. I hope that they got the cancer. And I prayed with them. I prayed with them that the cancer was gone, that she would be rehabilitated, and she would be returned to her job as state representative. Now, we don't agree on religion. We have differences. But you know what the Bible tells me? The Bible tells me to pray for those who are in authority. Doesn't it tell me to do that? And isn't she in an authoritative position that can protect some of the things that I want to be able to do as God's child? And isn't the right thing to show compassion when a person is hurting? That doesn't sweep our differences under the comma. That doesn't mean that we don't have differences. We do. But you also want to set a good example that you still are concerned about that person, even despite religious differences. You know why I do that? To keep the door open. So we might be able at some point in some time to talk about our religious differences. And you know what? Somebody may be more willing to talk to you if they think that you have a genuine concern about their person. You know what? How easy is that to do? How easy is that for us to do? To show people that we are concerned about them. That doesn't erase the differences, but it demonstrates a love that I'm to have. Do I just love people who agree with me? Is that what God tells me to do, just love people? You know, the Bible takes the opposite of that. He says, if you just love people who love you, how different are you than the world? Even the world does that. You've got to love people who don't love you. That's what real love does. But you know what? Later on, if we get into a discussion, I'm not gonna back down from what I believe. I'm not going to change my belief. I'm going to conduct myself in a way that I'm going to stand for the truth. And I never should be ashamed to do that. Bears all things, to remain steady under trial, to hold up under another or conceal or to hide. You know, sometimes the weight of things can be unbearable. Sometimes the things that happen in our lives can just smother us, can just overwhelm us because we're not prepared or we don't know what to do or we don't know where to go. And sometimes you just need to pray that God helps you to bear whatever the burden is. But sometimes you need to help people to know that they're not alone, that you can help them bear the burden. You believe all things. You want to believe the best until the evidence proves otherwise. Consider all the evidence and do what is best. Believe what is best. Don't think the worst. Always think the best. You know, this is a problem that we have in the church, generally speaking, that we need to correct. Why is it that in a given situation, we'll think the worst of a given situation instead of thinking the better? Why do we always go to the negative? I don't understand that. That's something I wish we'd improve upon. When we don't look at a situation and the first thing we think about is what's wrong with it instead of what could be right with it. You see, we believe all things. We bear all things. We hope all things. When evidence is adverse, let's still hope for the best. Even when it doesn't look good to me, I'm still going to hope for the best. I'm still going to hope that we can work this out, that this can be found a good solution. It endures all things. Love sticks it out. It doesn't put it under any of those circumstances. You know what? Not everybody's lovable. Not every situation is easy. Sometimes you've got to endure some things. Sometimes you have to give of yourself. Sometimes you're going to have to accept some things that are very hard to accept. But that's what love does. Love endures all things. Now, listen to me. Love is not always easy. It's not. Sometimes love is very difficult because the person that you're dealing with or the situation you're dealing with is very difficult. And it can even be personal. Let me close with a biblical, with a real life illustration. And I've used this before, but it fits here. There was a Christian lady who was 8.5 months pregnant. And she was taking food to an elderly couple on a Saturday night. And on the way home, it was getting about dusk, and on the way home, a drunk crossed the center line, hit her head on, killed her instantly, and killed the baby a few hours later. The baby died. The man that had hit her went into a coma and was in the hospital for about 3 weeks. When he came out of the coma, sitting by beside his bed was the mother who lost her daughter and lost her grandchild by the hands of this man. To make a long story short, that couple taught that individual the truth. And he obeyed the truth. He went to prison for 3 years for his crime of being under the influence and causing with his vehicle a death. He went to, I think he was sentenced to 7 years and he got out in 4. Today, that man is a member of the church, active, faithful, and striving to serve God. The parents of that woman killed converted him to the truth. Could you have done that? Could you have had that much love for that man that you would want to share the truth with him? Could you have done that if that had been your daughter? Your grandchild? Could you have enough love for him to want to bring him to the truth? To give him an opportunity to recover from his mistake? That'd be hard, wouldn't it? That'd be difficult, wouldn't it? But is that not what God calls upon us to do? Is that exactly what God calls us to do if we really love the sinner? If we really love the sinner, isn't that what our duty is? Isn't that what we should do? It wouldn't be easy, but that would be the right thing to do if I truly loved that person. You see, brethren, one of the things I want you to understand, love is not always convenient. It doesn't always fit the way we like it to, but love is always the right course to pursue. Love believes all things, hopes all things, bears all things, endures all things. That type of love will always win out. That's what God calls upon us to do. Please take your psalm book, turn to page 319. If you're here this morning and you need to make some correction in your life, to make your life right with God, or if you're here, you're not a child of God, and you need to make that initial step in obeying the gospel. We have Lori here. We're ready to help assist you. If you believe, if you're willing to repent and confess your sin, turn away from sin, acknowledge them, and submit to baptism and wash away your sin by the blood of Christ. We're here to help you do that. If you're here and you are a Christian, and you're not living the kind of life that you should, you're not following the course that God gave you to follow, and you need to make some correction, and you need prayer for forgiveness, or you need prayer for strength and comfort, we're here to help you in any way we can. And if we can help you, we're here to do so as together we stand, as we sing.